This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you in part by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get the true crime that's worth your time delivered to your inbox every weekday at bestevidence.fyi. And now, on with our episode.
I've never met the girl, but I've seen pictures of her. She just has that look that I remember. But I see that look and it's like, you little snot. How could you do that to a human being, you 90210 piece of crap?
Do I? Not quite a year after Lifetime took on the story of Michelle Carter, Conrad Roy, and the question of who caused Roy's death, Aaron Lee Carr examines both sides of the question in HBO's two-part I Love You, Now Die, The Commonwealth versus Michelle Carter. And Eve Beatty, having suffered through If Words Could Kill in episode 71, is back to, quote, enjoy a more considered version. Later, we're both completing our case punch cards when we discuss Paul Schrader's 1988 investigation into Patty Hearst's kidnapping. Is it possible for me to enjoy any coverage of that case at this point? Why were radicals so annoying? And shouldn't Michelle Carter's parents have had a word with her about those Instagram eyebrows in court? All these questions and more in The Blotter Presents, episode 103. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the principle that while crime is bad, stories about crime can be pretty good. I am joined again today by my working partner on True Crime Review newsletter Best Evidence, Eve Beatty. Hello, Eve.
Hello.
No Bella Thorne this time, but some thorny questions in our most wanted section.
Oh, man.
We are discussing, as I noted, I Love You, Now Die, The Commonwealth versus Michelle Carter. As you are listening to this, one episode has aired on HBO and the second episode is set to air tonight. Before we begin, a content warning. I Love You, Now Die does discuss the death of Conrad Roy. He did die by suicide. Not every listener is going to find this suitable material. There is also discussion of eating disorders and self-harm. This may not be for you, and if it isn't, I urge you to skip to the cold case section. And now the case file, which I basically lifted from episode 71's rundown doc. On July 13, 2014, authorities found Conrad Roy's body in his pickup truck in a parking lot where, the night before, he had attached a water hose to his exhaust pipe to fill the cab with the carbon monoxide that killed him. Investigators soon discovered a series of text messages, eventually more than 1,000, according to prosecutors, sent in the week prior to Roy's death that were between him and Michelle Carter, who said she was his girlfriend. Among those were texts she sent that stated, quote, you always say you're going to do it, but you never do. I just want to make sure tonight is the real thing. Quote, you just have to do it. And quote, it's painless and quick. Police also found Carter's written admission to a friend in which she recalled a phone call with Roy after he got out of his truck and told her he was scared and didn't want to abandon his family. Get back in, Carter said she told him. That is from People magazine in 2017. This case, I think this case was very easy to reduce to the texting case or the, you know, suicide by text case. And I Love You, Now Die does an excellent job, I think, of showing both sides of the question of whether Michelle Carter is responsible in any way for Conrad Roy's death. What did you think of the miniseries overall? It's really a two-part movie. What did you think of it overall?
Well, I thought that, we should not keep comparing it to the Lifetime thing because that was, that was crap. So it's like not even fair. But, you know, watching this, I did suddenly remember what it was like to be a teenage girl and yes. The fraught in our case, because we are old, phone conversations. Like, I really went back to the whole thing where we took, and kids, you can ask your parents about all this, where you take the phone, and we didn't have a cordless phone, so I had to like pull it through the back door and sort of shut the back door on it. And you'd have these intense, like, dramatic phone conversations about stuff that's completely inconsequential, but felt so real and so intense because being a teenager is so goddamn boring.
It's very boring, and it's also like intensely dramatic with absolutely no perspective. And also oldsters like ourselves being like, you know, don't be so dramatic, or, you know, get over it, or one day you'll see whatever it is. And it is difficult to portray this psychologically gusty time in teenagers' lives without kind of succumbing to some of the like just humorless, perspective-free melodrama that does characterize it. I question some of the visual choices that Carr makes. The action sort of takes place in a coastal area of Massachusetts, and she kind of combines the fog of that place with the fog that was filling Conrad's car in the credits.
Oh, I felt the credits to me did not belong with this show.
No.
The credits to me felt like, I mean, I don't know, it felt like a show on like one of those like weird networks you get on your smart TV or your Roku or something that's like, you know, vagina fantasy horror channel or something. That's what it felt like to me. It didn't feel like anything that I was supposed to take seriously. And it didn't help that it was that sort of like, you know, very generic sort of something that comes up on your Spotify station because you happen to listen to a Katy Perry song once or something. All I could figure, because it felt so dissonant to me, is that that was like a studio or a marketing or something decision, because it didn't feel consistent to me with the rest of how the show was packaged.
Yeah, I think that's correct. There was one Chiron early on where much of the quote action is, or the challenge for Carr is to successfully, you know, imbue these texts with visual momentum. So like you're doing kind of a fair bit of reading. Overall, I think she does an excellent, effective job. But there is one Chiron where Conrad is expressing his misery and just exhaustion. And there's like the sort of B-roll is the seashore, and there's a seagull walking around like behind the Chiron and sort of looking skeptically at it in that way of seagulls. And when I'm thinking from like Finding Dory, when I'm like narrating like mine over this expression of utter torment from this poor boy, it's like, well, I mean maybe wait for a shot where the seagull isn't wandering.
Oh yeah, my husband came in actually during that part and did like the seagull voice, you know, like, hey guys, and I'm like, it's a show about suicide, shut up.
Well, but the show did, I mean, that to itself.
Yeah.
The show is divided into two parts. Like I said, the first part is the prosecution, the second part is the defense. But I think Carr sort of fires a small shot across the bow when in the like contemporary coverage B-roll that every one of these documentaries always includes about whatever case it is, she includes this snippet.
Go ahead and do it. Do it, babe. Why haven't you done it yet? What is that puss on her face? Hold on, back it up, Liz. Okay, hold everything.
Police say at one point before Roy died, he got scared, got out of the truck, and called Carter. Carter told him to get back in.
The idea that she told him to get back in the truck and finish the job is the crux of the state's case against her, of course. But would you say that by including this this fragment of Nancy Grace that Carr is signaling whose, quote, side she's on?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that, you know, the Nancy Grace and how you feel about Nancy Grace is kind of more of an inside baseball thing. And then later on, you know, because I have the same, I'm Nancy Grace to me is a, you know, God bless her. She's a clown to me. Like, I mean, you know, if we, it's, we can have a whole other conversation on another.
I had to.
Yes, you did. But we could have another conversation another day about like her corrosive influences and probably, you know, really nail some
and
stuff
she's
down. But
got
to me, she
a new show coming up like in a week, so we probably will.
About unjust conviction. So that too was in a whole other topic. Mm. You know, I think she's a joke. The person that I sort of imagined Aaron Carr was trying to get me to side against was Dr. Oz, who we also see with Conrad's parents, just like, oh, it's just awful. I mean, Dr. Oz, I think, is, you know, my Nancy Grace, because I mean, that guy to me, he's like, you know, such my chode nemesis in so many different ways. And so once I saw that, I was like, oh, fuck all these people, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the prosecution's argument is basically that she, first of all, that up to a certain point, her like providing a listening ear for Roy's statements that he was planning to take his own life was not criminal. But at the moment that she told him to get back in the car, something that they only have her, the only evidence of this is that she told a friend that that's what happened.
And the line is a questionable line. It's like, it is to me, it feels so dramatically sort of loaded. And I fucking told him to get back in the car, which everyone kept spelling F-U-C-K-E-N, which also really irritates me.
Very Massachusetts, I think.
Okay, good. I appreciate that then. Because to me, it's I-N with an apostrophe at the end. But to me, it felt like a dramatically delivered line. So then in the second episode, we see, this is not a spoiler, how influenced she was by the dialogue it's alleged that she was very influenced by the dialogue and sort of the verbiage used by Lea Michele to talk about the overdose death of her fiance. And I thought, yeah, this sounds like a line that she sort of thought out and maybe practiced or something and delivered dramatically. Because once again, this show totally put me back in being a teenage girl and remembering how I would come up with what I imagined people said in various circumstances too.
Absolutely, because that's the other plank in the prosecution's case, is that Michele encouraged this course of events because she felt that once Roy had died, that she would be able to draft off of this tragedy to get attention and develop closeness and intimacy for herself. And I'm not sure where I actually come down on that question. We have a couple of clips to do with this, but before we get to that, you had a clip that you called for from the first episode where Esquire reporter Jesse Barron, who wrote a long exegesis of the case, and we'll link that in the show notes, and he appears a lot in this documentary and I think is quite cogent on various points. He's talking about her sort of courtroom appearance. Shall we play the clip and then discuss? All right.
Yeah, please.
The producer whispered, "Is that her?" And all heads turn. Michele, wearing a white quilted car coat and high heels, is coming toward us. And there was this feeling of a weird sort of inverse star power that was put on her. She was thin, she was blonde, she was tanning booth tan. It felt like she knew she was going to be photographed.
I'm interested to hear why you called for that clip, because I don't think this assessment is close enough to his article that this is one of the places where he sounds a little canned, where he doesn't usually, but I would also say that this made me almost more sympathetic to Michelle, given what we hear about later, because I think that she, you know, in all the footage we see, she is wearing high heels, which she's not totally in control of. She has these very dramatic, very a couple years ago, big, dark Instagram brows that don't that are not the look for this situation. And there's something about her playing this role that she thinks she's supposed to be playing, of like the grown-up sort of somberly and chicly facing the consequences of her actions, that's both off-putting and also just sort of pitiable.
Well, so the reason I chose this quote was because, you know, as you pointed out, Jess Barron, he drives the narrative of this entire show. Mm. I think, like, you know, he is in this a lot. He is probably quoted, I didn't like time it or anything, but I'd say he's quoted more than Conrad's family, more than any other expert, like that great old guy.
Who we will also hear from in a clip.
Yeah, more than anyone else. So a lot, Jess sort of provides.
And he looks like the actor.
He looks like so many actors.
So who was on Rectify. Anyway, continue talking and I'll look that up.
But so he, you know, he provides the sort of the skeleton.
Thank you.
Yes, you're right. But, you know, and I think sort of guides, you know, I think that Aaron Lee Carr is using how he characterizes things to tell us how to feel a lot of the time, so that we got this quote. This is one of the first times we hear from him, and we get this quote. And I find this quote very troubling because for a variety of reasons. Okay, so she's blonde. She's always been blonde. Or on and off. I mean, you're a high school girl, but it's not like she showed up, you know, suddenly looking like the diplomat from Los Espookies. You know, it was a normal sort of teenage girl blonde. She was in high heels, which is when you are a woman, how you are expected, you're expected to wear high heels when you're doing something formal, like going to church or to your trial. She was thin. Well, we know she had an eating disorder. You're expected to be thin. She was also a teenage girl. She was tanning bed tan. I would like to know how, as a journalist, he can quantify a tanning bed tan over some other form of tan or a spray tan or whatever else. How does he know it was tanning bed tan? Those words were chosen very carefully. Tanning bed tan was chosen extremely carefully. As if she knew she were going to be photographed, or, I don't know, sitting in a courtroom on trial. That we're criticizing this woman for being dressed to go to trial. She's dressed modestly. She's dressed like a grown-up. She's not wearing anything that would be weird to wear to a job interview for your first job out of high school. You know, and so that all of this was placed in this way, in that, you know, Barron's words were used to frame how, you know, she was perceived, and that there were these loaded terms, to me, suggests that he has this very specific perception of what this teenage woman is like, and she's not a teenage at this point, but, you know, that's what he is rolling with, so that then he was the guy who was providing the skeleton for all this other stuff. That was his initial quote, sort of cast everything for me sort of in doubt with him.
Well, I didn't find it that bothersome, except that, like I said, it did sound kind of canned and like he was fond of the description. I will say that there's a moment later on where he sort of wraps up talking about something that she was doing, or some way in which she seemed to be mentally, if not outright ill, then non-standard, let's say. And then he sort of looks away from the camera for a while. That could have been him acting. I don't think so. I think he was legitimately disturbed by this case and what he was talking about. But it is interesting that the way, first of all, that this is a man talking about a woman's appearance in this film made by a woman that's a filmmaker who often takes on controversial women, let's say, and that the guy who gets the commentator who gets the most talking head time is a man, is of note. Not that he's a bad commentator, it's just interesting. But there's also, there's a dividing line between Michelle as a child and Michelle as an adult that I think his commentary is also focusing us on, because I think if I were her parents and her team, I would have gone with a flat and no makeup and a bun or pigtails or something that emphasized her youth a little more than what she ended up going with. She looked fine, but I'm, you know, some of it is the criticism of her appearance that every woman gets. And some of it is about whether she's projecting a youthful / not responsible enough image. So that's sort of what I took from it.
Sure.
What I definitely took from this was, I don't think that I have consumed a property this evocative of what it is like to be in your mid to late teens and feel like people like you, but nobody really knows you, and you're not really a part of anything, and you have friends, but no best friends, than this. It was not a sensation I cared to revisit, but it's certainly evocative, and it does create more sympathy, I think, for Michelle Carter's desperation to feel like she was a part of some intense narrative in someone's life. Here is the prosecution trying to make it out as though her motivation was to correct this state of affairs.
The next day, 7/13/2014, do you get a message from Michelle Carter?
Yes.
What does she ask you?
Can we do something tonight to get my mind off of it?
So on the night of the 12th, she texts you that Conrad killed himself, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then the next day, she asks you if you want to hang out.
Yes.
Okay. In the days following Conrad's death, she sought attention and sympathy, posting frequently on Facebook about how she missed him. People started texting her, consoling her, visiting her, and she suddenly became important.
What did you do after you heard that?
I went to see her.
And was that something that you would normally do?
It's something I would normally do for a friend that was having a difficult time.
No, I'm asking you, would you normally do that for Michelle Carter? Or in her house?
No, not usually.
Oh, girl world. I don't miss you. Yeah, this is the way that Aaron Lee Carr takes certain bits of the trial footage and of the... I think she teases out what the prosecution and the defense respectively are trying to do and puts them in an order in a very
way. Was that a question? I mean, I think that she does that. And I think also, you know, like to your earlier point on, you know, on like sort of that so much of it were these text exchanges, the way that, you know, that is sort of peppered throughout it. You know, it definitely sugarcoats the pill. But I think that, you know, when we're hearing stuff like this from the prosecution, sometimes it does get a little repetitive. I don't know. I don't have a proposed fix for that. But I was sort of like, especially in the second episode, which is a little bit longer, I was sort of like, you guys, I got it.
Yeah, there were some things that could have been cut there, especially since I suspect that when we get to the part where Michelle Carter is identifying with not just Leah Michelle's character on Glee, but Leah Michelle herself, to the point where there is a like blurring of borderlines. I am not a doctor, mm-hmm. but whatever. Like there is something there that I think nobody is quite able to diagnose effectively or accurately, or kind of get their arms around in terms of translating it to a documentary audience. So instead, Carr sort of retreats to the relative safety of trial footage and exchanges and stuff like that. So, which I don't blame her, because to try to boil down what is happening in Michelle Carter's mind vis-a-vis the Glee situation is, I mean, I don't think I necessarily can do it.
Well, and I didn't really follow Lea Michele's reactions to the passing of her fiance, but the two clips that we had, I was sort of like, can we get a show about this? Because,
yeah.
I think maybe it doesn't help that I finally just watched A Star Is Born. So, you know, spoiler alert, at the end of A Star Is Born, that character Lady Gaga plays is crying, as, you know, and it's all sad because she's singing a song about her dead husband, Bradley Cooper. Then we see Lea Michele basically doing the same thing. So all of it was sort of like in the soup in my head of Lea Michele crying and singing, and, you know, Lady Gaga crying and singing, and was, you know, Michelle also imagining, you know, this scenario where she's in the spotlight, you know, crying and singing. Is that what Homers for Conrad was supposed to be? Homers for Conrad? Yeah.
Yeah. And there is, well, we'll get into that. But first, I would like to play a clip of Jesse Barron talking about the narrative that sprang up around this case almost immediately after Michelle Carter was indicted. And he does an excellent job outlining the powers that are attributed to teenage girls going back centuries in order to pinion them. Here is clip 5.
Almost immediately after the indictment, there was a narrative that got set that didn't change. And it was set in the community, it was set in town, it was set in the press. And that is of this heartless bitch who killed a guy to get popular. And the reason that's such a compelling story is it combines two things that people feel about teenage girls. One of them is that they are, they're coercive, that they have a kind of secret power that men don't have, that boys don't have, and that they can use it. The other thing is that they're crazy and they only live for attention and they just want to be popular and they're vapid. And so in saying that Michelle was this like coercive ice queen who killed a guy in order to become popular, it was like the perfect combination of everything that people hate about teenage girls.
Yikes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right on. And I think that you can find a gazillion exemplars of this sort of in real life. You can find it in the Salem Witch Trials. You can find it in, what is that movie with Laura Dern and Treat Williams?
Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been?
Yes, that's the story that it's based on, which I think in both story and film form is another very evocative look at this, the power that a teenage girl feels like she might have and then is swiftly punished for having, when in reality she has almost none at all, or doesn't know how to control it in the event. Again, it's interesting that they have the dude drawing these conclusions, but he's not wrong. And he's, I think what he fails to say is that there's a depth to teenage girls that they're not given credit for, but that, like, there is also a shallowness and a drive to be popular, and those things can coexist and did coexist, at least for me.
It occurs to me that, you know, I would feel like 35% more comfortable with this whole show if we had gotten, say, either Tina Fey or the woman who actually wrote Queen Bees and Wannabes to also sort of weigh in on some of this stuff. Someone who has an inside understanding of how teenage women, you know, what that life is really like, and, you know, who has gone through it, as opposed to, you know, someone who maybe himself has been afraid of teenage girls at one point or another, and, you know, not that long ago.
Yeah. I don't think he was bad or anything. And again, the article is quite good. It's just telling perhaps, that he's sort of like the lead commentator when they do have other journalists giving talking head interviews who are, you know, they do have women. So at least he gave good, thoughtful soundbite. I don't, you know, I didn't feel like he was cynical about it, really. In any way. And I also don't think this defense expert, the old man doctor, was cynical either. He had a very interesting insight in a talking head interview that I don't know if this came up in court, but I think perhaps that might have been a more productive angle in terms of making Michelle Carter's actions slightly more or less inexplicable. Here's clip six.
It struck me that she was in an extremely abusive relationship. This is constant harassing of her while he's not telling family. And at one point toward the end, Conrad tells her, "The one thing that will make me hate you is if you tell anyone that I'm suicidal." And she listens. Michelle got it all. There's this huge pyramid of his misery, and at the bottom of it is sitting Michelle Carter and nobody else.
I was glad that he pointed that out, and I was also glad, and this was a risky move by Carr, to sort of touch on the idea that this is a lot for a girl who is trying to handle her own mental health struggles to be doing by herself, especially if she's maybe not entirely functioning strictly on a reality plane. Did you think that Carr did a good job of, you know, not blaming Conrad? That's not what I mean. But just reminding people, like, actually, he wasn't in, you know, in his saint's halo 100% of the time here.
You know, actually, this is a place where I felt like the Lifetime movie was somewhat more successful because the Lifetime movie also, you know, used a lot of these same texts that we saw today, and it dove way deeper into the sexually charged nature of a lot of the texts that Conrad sent her, the sort of, abusive is a strong term, but, like, you know, critical of her appearance and, you know, a lot of unpleasant things too that we did not see in the show. And I perhaps cynically wondered if part of how we guaranteed the participation of Conrad's parents were that we saw a little less of his really nasty side, because the halo for me was still pretty intact, you know, other than those remarks that you just sort of highlight from the doctor. A lot of the really unpleasant texts that he sent her, which you can easily find online, you know, transcripts of all of them, you know, we didn't really hit on that. But it's like, where do you go with that? You know, if you only have a few hours, it's like, well, she alleged that he sexually assaulted her, or did he? You know, there were a lot of things like that that I would have loved to have a little more explanation of, and, you know, we could have saved some time on the other stuff, but I'm definitely Monday morning quarterbacking that part of it.
I had the same cynical suspicion that perhaps the participation of the Roy family was not contingent on, but, you know, that perhaps there were some promises made to low tone stuff. Or maybe
the domestic violence allegation, you know, because, well, we do have how sort of perfunctorily, did I pronounce that correctly? I don't even know, that we dealt with the domestic violence allegation. Conrad and his father had a physical altercation in which Conrad received a concussion. That this is according to, you know, police documents that we sort of see on screen. Conrad's dad addresses the fact, oh, we had an argument, we got into it, we fought, and that very well could be. Conrad was a 17-year-old kid. He looked, you know, pretty physically healthy. And I know as a teen that I, you know, probably did not always do a great, oh God, I hate thinking about this stuff. You know, did not always do a great job with, like, you know, my parents either. I don't recall ever physically attacking them, but I wasn't a boy. And, you know, so maybe that's what it was, or maybe it was domestic abuse. You know, maybe this did happen more than once, but that it came up and it just, like, you know, it was a drive-by. Something happened. But then we have, you know, that the information that Conrad apparently did have a concussion at some point, you know, not that far before he killed himself. That to me, especially in this day where we're all familiar with CTE, is really relevant information that, in my opinion, should have been explored more, at least during the trial, if not in the show. But once again, we sort of got the drive-by on that.
Well, and that there was also, apparently this divorce was bitter and people putting hands on each other was not an alien concept in this household and within the parents' relationship. There are many, many like comorbid factors here that I'm not saying that Michelle Carter did not play her part, and I'm not saying that she at a certain point did not become responsible, because if her account in her texts to her friend Sam are accurate, and again, who knows, there's some shifting sands of reality perhaps with Michelle Carter's version of anything, but if that's what happened, yes, she's responsible. But they were both teenagers who had been hospitalized, each of them, for various mental health struggles, and who do not have the, like, cortical wherewithal to understand the permanence of this action versus the attraction of the drama. And, like, I'm not saying she wasn't responsible. I didn't pull this clip, but there's some commentator who's like, it may be Jesse Baron, who's like, look, both sides want someone to blame for this. And, you know, of course they do. That's a natural and human reaction. But I'm not entirely sure what, like, without hearing what Michelle thinks happened, which we will never hear, probably, it's really hard to know what anyone was thinking and whether it was pinned to reality in any way. And adding to that is the dissociative quality of these interactions that take place online or via text. And they do have an expert come and talk about that in clip 7.
When people are communicating through text, strange things can start to happen. You don't necessarily experience the other person as another person. You can't see them, you can't hear them, you can't see their body language. You have this voice with you all day long that will suddenly pop up and say things to you. I think in some ways people experience that as a voice in their head, almost as if it's like an internal hallucination. You're really interacting with these characters inside your mind without really understanding on a more conscious, rational level. These text messages are coming from another person with their own life and their own thoughts and their own feelings.
What did you think of that assessment of the situation?
Well, I feel that way about Slack way more than I do about texting. But I thought that that was a really interesting and a good way to put it, because text on the screen, I do think that we have all, you know, that's somebody on a forum, that's, you know, somebody that's somewhere else, and it no longer, in a lot of ways, feels like a direct, I think that I'm old enough that I think of texting as a direct form of communication, the way that, you know, people commenting on Facebook or whatever, if I used Reddit, you know, how I'd feel about people on Reddit. But I can see where it would all be blurred like that. I thought that the way this guy put it was a little flowery, but I got where he was coming from, and I don't think he's completely off base.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I have been extremely online since minutes after Al Gore invented it. I think there's an aspect also of code switching that you're not even aware of, or at least I'm not conscious of anymore. I I think that having grown up in a world where this was always true, where you had this remove available to you since you were little, is very different from the experience of people our age who remember like the phone calls on a phone with a cord and having to, you know, like having relationships with people in meat space because there was only meat space. But on the other hand, like I have working partnerships where I've never actually laid eyes on the person in person.
Sarah, hi. Who knows who I actually am? I could be a 500-year-old slug that lives in a yard and just, you know, is like kiting off someone's Wi-Fi signal right now. Who knows?
That's why your dad isn't the Zodiac. You're the Zodiac.
It's true.
But I think it's worth having an expert come and point out, like, actually, this is a different experience. Like, neurologically, how we experience each other is not just physically different, but psychologically. And because we're also used to it now, it's worth having it pointed out again.
And I think if you're skeptical about this, all you need to do is think about a movie that you've watched that has subtitles. And if you play like that movie in your head, you'll hear the dialogue in English, even though you're watching it in another language. And that to me, like, sort of like affirms everything that, you know, that this shrink or whoever it was, you know, had to say about that. The fact that I can play dialogue in my head from a movie that I didn't actually hear anyone say, but, you know, since I read it in English, I hear it in English in my brain. And I think that's a very common experience. That's proof to me that there you can have that sort of, you know, cognitive sort of switch that, you know, I'm sure when you're a teenager and your brain is just still made out of cheese is even crazier.
Absolutely. And the ways in which the sort of experience of intake of information is different, whether you're like making notes in longhand or writing it even. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's like what we still don't understand about all of this is a lot. And again, what we're going to understand about Michelle's adoption doesn't begin. I'll just play the clip. This is Jesse Barron sort of trying to explain how Michelle Carter seemed to be over-relating to the death of Corey Monteith and how that affected Leah Michelle. I did make a couple of cuts in the clip because the you know, Leah Michelle's remarks are then accompanied by an on-screen rendition of Michelle's texts, which are like almost verbatim what Leah Michelle is saying. So assume that that's happening. And here is clip 8.
It's sort of the first moment where you realize that Michelle has like a completely other story that's going on that has nothing to do with Conrad specifically. But the idea that she would be the person in Glee who had a boyfriend who was the quarterback who had sort of tragically died, I think was kind of more real to her than it probably is to most people. One of the eerie parts of the text messages that Michelle sent to her friends, where she quotes from Leah Michelle, is that they don't all come from Glee. They come from interviews that the real actress is giving about her real dead boyfriend to real talk show hosts.
I literally lived every day of my life feeling like the luckiest girl in the whole world. I just thought he was the greatest man.
This is weird. This is really weird.
Yeah,
it is.
I wasn't sure what he was characterizing there, but yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's all very weird, but I think there's also an intensity to an unhappy teenager's relationship with either fictional characters or celebrities that is not even aspirational, but like deliberately fantastical, that I'm like, we may not even have words for it still. I'm sure actual people who went to school to become psychologists will have terms for it, and I look forward to hearing from those people if they're listening. But there is this, yes, it's weird, but I also understood it in some visceral way, even if I would do a piss poor job explaining it. I don't know about you.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I have like a sort of like celebrity cognate for anything like that when, you know, I was a kid, but I think that too. And then you add to that the fact that you can have this sort of relationship with these people and believe that you know them via social media. Yeah. It gives you one more layer of, you know, hey, I'm just like Lea Michele, you know, and, or I can be like this person because I can have this experience and then have this sort of this public adoration or self-flagellation or whatever you want. Yeah.
It's the negation of self and circumstance, I guess.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
It would have been for me. Like I didn't have, again, there was no social media because we're from the past, but there was definitely this strong sense of wanting to be somewhere that's else, as Cordelia once said on Buffy, or someone who is else. And I can still feel like when they're talking about this, like, yes, it's weird, but I can feel it like it's a like the smell of a Madeleine, that it's like, yes, I don't exactly get it, and yet I completely get it.
Where the only place you have to go is to your room.
A loose leaf notebook that you stupidly put diary on the front of and nail polish about how much you hate your mom. And then she finds it. Hey, Barb. Still not sorry. Whoops. Still technically grounded. there are some little missteps, like the credits. There is a little bit too much time maybe spent on trial testimony or trial footage that kind of, like, either this or the talking head about this, but we don't necessarily need both, particularly in part two, which may be an effort to compensate for the fact that while Michele Carter's attorney is on camera, Michele and her family are not heard from in talking head interviews. But I was surprised. I was not surprised at how good this was or how much I got from it. I was surprised by the ways in which it was good and striking. I mean, Aaron Lee Carr, you know, in Aaron Lee Carr, I trust, but I found this, it was like a little unnerving and depressing. I think it was unnerving for the commentators, for the participants. Like I said, Jesse Barron has a couple moments where he's like, looks like he might weep. Of course, it's a wretched experience to relive for Conrad's family and friends. But it's, I mean, I think it's really good and compelling, and I was not bored.
Yeah, I think it's worth watching. I watched both episodes in a row because, you know, like, this was work and we had to do it. I wouldn't, especially if you were or have ever been a teenage girl. I'm not going to say it was like triggering for me or anything like that. There was something about it that I did not enjoy it as fully as I might have if I'd had a little bit of a break and maybe more carbs that day. So I would, you know, I think it's a good show. I think it's worth a watch. I don't think it's the least pleasant thing you can put yourself through, but I would definitely take it easy on myself if I were watching it, especially if you felt like you had a rough time as a teen.
Yeah, I agree. It got awfully close to me.
Ways
that were narratively admirable, but not enjoyable.
Oh yeah,
but yes,
not. That
is I Love You Now Die. It is it should be on HBO Go, at least the first half by the time you are listening to this. Two-hour cold case. I think that I have now seen everything, read everything, watched everything, listened to everything possible on Patricia Hearst. thanks to our cold case, which is Paul Schrader's 1988 docudrama starring Natasha Richardson. Here's the case file in case, I don't know, you've recently arrived from space. In February 1974, a radical organization called the SLA shocked America with the kidnapping of 19-year-old heiress Patricia Hearst. But within weeks, the young woman known to the world as Patty would do something even more disturbing. She would join her captors in their violent crimes. It created a chilling question that still divides America today. Was Patty Hearst a victim of brainwashing, or did this California college student willingly become an armed terrorist? Okay, so...
Well, Sarah, I chose this property because I wanted to do... I wanted another enigmatic woman that we all feel like we know what they're thinking, but we don't really know. So, and so when you said, oh, pick a cold case, I thought, okay, what sort of ticks those boxes?
Yeah, I think that's a solid through line when put next to...
Yeah,
it's not completely random, folks.
Yeah, it's not. And then I was like, well, now I have to find a Patty Hearst thing that Sarah hasn't seen. And I was lucky. I was really surprised that you hadn't seen this, because this cast is, you'll recognize everyone in this if you watch this movie, which I don't recommend that you do.
No.
But it's also Ving Rhames, who is young and very fit.
Yes, very fit. He has not yet had the meats.
He has not had the meats. Like, but everybody, you recognize everyone from TV, movies, something else. Like, yep. Every single person
Francis
you see, you're
Fisher,
like, oh, yeah, that guy.
William Forsythe, mm-hmm. Dana Delaney.
William Forsythe, also young and fit, but still rocking that same mustache.
Oh, God. All right, well, let's hear Ving Rhames giving his introductory pitch to Patty, who at this point has just been kidnapped like 2 days before and is in a closet with like Brillo pads taped over her eyes. I'm not really sure what Paul Schrader wants us to think he thinks of the SLA.
My name is Sin.
Like the devil?
Sin Q. I'm the General Field Marshal of the Symbionese Liberation Army.
What's that?
Everybody know about the SLA.
How can you be so dumb? SLA killed Marcus Foster.
You are a prisoner of war. We're going to negotiate a prisoner exchange to free our two comrades who are now being beaten and tortured in the fascist prison system of America.
I will give him this. First of all, This take on the carceral state remains hot. Second of all, that he is able to so clearly convey the K, that is obviously how America is spelled in his conception of the universe, quite amazing. But, oh my God, the SLA, like, maybe it's just that I have consumed so much material about this case, but they just make me so impatient and tired.
Well, there is that scene where they meet with members of the Black Muslim community, which, you know, there's a whole sort of side conversation about the Black Muslim community in the Bay Area and how out of that was built the Bay family, the Your Black Muslim Bakery folks. Google these terms and you'll see that there's a lot of like really good stuff here. And I feel like maybe we discussed this on another podcast where we discussed one of the young Bay kids and how and the bakery. Anyway, there's this whole thing like involving the SLA didn't necessarily die, and their actions did not necessarily die following all this. The Your Black Muslim Bakery people, which I think is what they were sort of suggesting was going on there when we saw the Black Muslims meet with them, that was like a for real thing and a for real like sort of army that they were building there too. But those guys didn't do shit either.
Yeah.
Anyway, my point is that, you know, nobody can get anything done in the Bay Area, I guess, is my real point.
There are any number of radical groups that sort of adopted prison escapees and institutionalized, you know, people in the like Shawshank sense without really understanding what that commitment meant. I th- I feel like Paul Schrader is trying to sort of communicate how not well-meaning, yeah, but how I don't know. I think he's trying to make a comment that is somewhat withering about these groups and their deluded, yeah, beliefs about their potential to lead a revolution. But unfortunately, and I don't know if it's the film or if it's just overexposure to this case in the last year or two for me, but it did not hold my attention. But certainly I think he's trying to mock the SLA and in particular William Forsythe's character, who in the next clip is trying to teach Patty Hearst / Tanya how to draw quickly enough not to get killed, and then turns this teachable moment into an opportunity to rape her, basically. Here's clip 10.
Aim higher. You gotta get up here. Aim for the stomach, aim for the chest, okay? Come on. We'll do it one more time, all right? Throw. You're dead.
I'm always dead. It's just not fair, you know? I can't protect myself.
You're doing all right. You're doing good. No, I'm serious. Mm-hmm. No, you're doing good. You are. You are, really. Listen. I'm thinking that maybe it's the time that you and me got together.
What?
Do I have a need? It's a comradely thing to do. Right, comrade?
All right.
Yeah. It was always the comradely thing for a woman to submit to these needs, and that never went both ways. This character is also shown in blackface several times, which I think was supposed to... I'm not sure what that was supposed to do, honestly.
Well... Yeah, and yeah, there were, I think that everybody was in blackface at another point when they're going off to do a job or something. So I wasn't clear if it was like, oh, we're doing like commando things, so we're less visible, or if it actually was full on like, this is how we questionably express solidarity.
I think it was both, actually. But then yeah. William Forsythe, like the thing I remember him most from is Raising Arizona, in which he could not have been pastier specimen of humanity. So it's hard for me to say what this movie is trying to say, keeping in mind that this is probably the first like rendition of this story, right?
I mean, by then, think about this, by then Patty Hearst had already been in John Waters movies as like herself. Well, you know, like Patty Hearst, the woman Patty Hearst who had survived all this, is out there, is in public. And yeah, so like, because I think Crybaby must have come out before that, and I think she was in another one even previous to that too. So, you know, Patty Hearst was part of the conversation. We knew about her. We knew her deal. We knew her story. So obviously, Paul Schrader thought that there was something new to say about it. And if I had to guess, and this is a guess, is that he thought that he was maybe empowering Patty in a way that she hadn't been previously by allowing her to sort of provide the voiceover narration throughout the film. And there's a scene at the end once she's in prison where she's like making the calls on who her defense is going to be and all that, a scene that I find extremely dubious. Having some familiarity with the Hearst family, I really don't think that her dad would have been like, whatever you want, honey, fire F. Lee Bailey and hire whoever you want, even if he's not the best attorney. Yeah. I mean, the Hearst family, obviously, it has like a sort of an overblown quality, I think, A, to those of us who live in the Bay Area like I do, and B, to those of us who've worked in the media, because the Hearst Corporation, you know, that's magazines, it's Citizen Kane, it's ranches, it's stakes, it's real estate. So, you know, these people are are incredibly wealthy, including Patty. And, you know, so that they sort of drove by her immense wealth and privilege, you know, on their way to, oh, we're in the army. I thought was an interesting choice if we're trying to empower her within the story. But I don't know what they're going for. It seemed like a bad play.
Yeah, I'll play our last clip, which is she's like sort of hiding in a bathroom and freaking out because the firefight and fire that killed most of this cell has just occurred, and she's having a meltdown. And this voiceover is both, it's a good showcase for Richardson's rendition of Patty Hearst's accent and sort of lofty locution, for lack of a better term, which I think she's pretty good at imitating Patty Hearst. But it's also this elliptical point of view voiceover that we occasionally get, that it's like this borderline Malick-y observational, like, tone poem that he needed to either do nothing but that or cut it. I just feel like it needed to be much more strongly subjective in its point of view if it was trying to empower her as a character in this drama in which historically she was trying to be held not responsible. Anyway, here's clip 11.
It died exactly how they expected to. Police thought I was in there. The reporter said I was in there. If I had been, I'd be dead too. They think I'm dead. I am dead. Now there's just Tico and Yolanda. Everything will be worse.
And here's the thing, the movie goes on for like 25 more minutes after that.
And
that's the part that I think enraged me the most.
It's an hour and 44 minutes. I didn't think that it was sort of on its face too long. I just think that I know the story, and it's one of those that now that this has been out in the culture for decades, I'm just not sure who this is for now. And like back then, I can see, I'm like, oh, remember this famous story? And here's Natasha Richardson, who bears more than a passing resemblance to her, and so on and so forth. It wasn't a sort of too listy biopic situation. It seemed like the movie was trying to be a little more like elliptical and artistic and poetic about this narrative that is very familiar at this point. But unfortunately for this movie, I am coming to it 30 years after it was made. I have seen every other version of this story, including the Smithsonian Channel and a podcast and Jeffrey Toobin's book, and I have nothing left for this story. This didn't move the ball for me at all. But I have to say, like, if you don't really know anything about the case, greetings, welcome to our planet. But unless you've recently showed up from a distant galaxy, I just don't think this is a good use of time. I don't think it's bad. I just think it's completely unnecessary.
Well, don't be like me and think, well, hey, Paul Schrader, Natasha Richardson, Ving Rhames. I mean, there's got, you know, sure, why not? Don't do that. You have other things to do with your time. You know, go clean out the front closet.
Yeah, it's true. I just wish he could, like, make it again. Take another run at it and cast, I don't know who you would cast. Who is that actor who is in maybe Silicon Valley? And she was in the San Junipero episode of Black Mirror.
I know who you're talking about. I can't remember her name.
Listeners, help me out when you have a moment, but she would be great. Like, let's just do this again, but be like
Michael Jordan as Ving Rhames.
Yes. Oh God. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Michael Jordan basically in full on Killmonger mode. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And who is going to play Ms. Moon? Not that she was called that in this.
Oh, well, you get.
Oh gosh.
Everyone I'm thinking about is too old.
Yeah. Same. Yeah, like make it again and just make it a little more like, don't be so linear, because we all know the story now. So just like drop the sound out sometimes, or just make it all her like journaling from prison or whatever, like something else, something new, because there is nothing like factual or linear left to say about this case.
I agree.
Do you have anything factual or linear to tell us about what else you're working on?
Well, I think that what I want to do is I want to, you guys have heard about Best Evidence. You are probably like, enough with Best Evidence. But one of the things that Sarah and I want to do is we want to cover the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos trial,
yes.
Which is set for next fall, fall of 2020. In San Jose, California. I live in San Francisco, so it's easy for me to get there. If we reach 3,000 subscribers for Best Evidence, we are going to cover the case in person. And the reason that we're pushing for this is really simple, because we want to be able to do this. And to do this, it has to be our job. And to be our job, it has to pay us what a job would pay. And so that's why we want to take this from something that right now gets us a little bit of money. Thank you very much for subscribing, everyone who has thus far, and turn it into something that we can really do full on for the 3 months that the trial will require. So to do that, we need 3,000 subscribers who are, you know, paying sort of the monthly $5 to get a daily dose of information about true crime in their inbox, which in my opinion is a deal, because I pay much higher subscriptions for much crummier, less interesting things. So I'm hopeful you'll agree. And we're at bestevidence.fyi for you to subscribe.
This is something of an undertaking, but we'd love to do it.
We've got a year.
We'd love to have you along for the ride. I will also add that it makes a great gift. All right, folks, coming up on The Blotter Presents, I'm not sure who we've got for next week or what we're talking about, but after that, Lonnie Diane Rich returns to talk about who killed Garrett Phillips. We'll also be talking about No One Saw a Thing, Free Meek Mill, like I said, and Alex Segura will be returning to discuss Leah Carroll and Miami Crime. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. And you can find me at Eves and my True Crime Review newsletter, bestevidence.com. FYI. Like the podcast? Tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other listeners can find us. Don't like the podcast? Don't tell a soul. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she's on Twitter at Eve B. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.